Good afternoon. Welcome to this presentation. I'm here to introduce our three presenters. Cynthia Powell is an assistant professor of chemistry from Abilene Christian University. Rob Hatherill is from Del Mar College, where he's a professor. And Daisy John is also from Del Mar College and an assistant professor there. They're going to talk about their NGLC Wave 1 grant, and the title of this presentation is Mobile Enhanced Inquiry-Based Learning. Cynthia?
Well, we have a small group, and we're all spread out, and this is not the way I'm used to talking. So we want a little bit of information from this group before we start. How many of you are faculty members? Okay. And so the rest of you are administrators or tech support kind of people? Would that be true? Instructional design? Okay. Okay. All right. So that gives us a little feel for the audience that we're talking to. We are going to be talking about the Mobile Enhanced Inquiry-Based Learning Initiative, and this is MEBL for short. And the way we're going to handle this is I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to the project, sort of the genesis of the project, how it came about. And then Rob and Daisy are going to talk about implementation on their campus, some nuts and bolts kinds of things that they did on their campus and what that process looked like for them. And then I'll come back and give you a little bit of the assessment data that we have for the beginning of this project in, when we've been deploying on a couple of campuses. So just to give you a little bit of background, you probably know that over the last 30 years there's been a huge push in education toward inquiry-based formats for education, particularly in the STEM disciplines. And in fact, the National Science Education Standards, published in 96, identified inquiry as being essential to science education. And we all know that, but yet surveys show that inquiry is not a commonly used way to teach in the STEM disciplines, particularly at the university level. And the reason it isn't is because it is very, very difficult to implement. And one of the major challenges to implementing inquiry-based learning, particularly in the laboratory, is the uneven preparation that our students come to us with. They have various backgrounds in laboratory skills and lab knowledge. We have some students who have had 2 years of perhaps AP chemistry, and another student who may have grown up in a small Texas town where they had maybe one burette for the entire school district and didn't have a lot of experience. And so we're tasked with educating these students from a variety of backgrounds and trying to all bring them up to level and asking them to go into a laboratory and plan their own experiments and think critically about how to design an experiment. And it can be a really, really challenging and difficult thing for the students and for the professor to do well. A lot of research has also shown that inquiry, though very effective, is only effective if it's supported extremely well. And if it's not supported extremely well, then students and faculty alike flounder. So the MEBL initiative is trying to leverage what we know to be happening in our classrooms, and that's the ubiquity of mobile tools for delivering the needed support in the lab. The ECAR report in 2010, which was 2011, I'm sorry, which was based on 2010 data, indicated that 62% of our students, university students nationwide, own an iPod. 55% own a smartphone. Of course, there's overlap in those. This doesn't include iPads and desktop mobile computers, laptop computers, that's what I'm trying to say. That saturation was growing at a rate of about 75% per year at that time. So in 2012, we can reasonably expect probably 80% of our students to come with one of these mobile devices in their pocket. So with that in mind, 4 years ago at ACU, we began developing MEBL, an approach to providing access to needed information and on techniques and skills, and also just background knowledge on that mobile platform. And the idea was to provide concise podcasts and other resources that are easily prepared, that are readily accessible to the students, that cover these skills or backgrounds, that students could access on an as-needed basis. So this information is traditionally provided in a pre-lab lecture, so we would do exactly what we're doing right here. I would stand in front of my class of two lab sections together, 60 students, and demonstrate how to titrate. And you can see, you know, a burette is about half the width of this microphone, so you're watching me try to demonstrate how to use a burette in front of the classroom. You don't have the piece of glassware directly in front of you, you may think you already know how to do this, so you're going to sleep not really paying much attention, or you may have absolutely no idea what I'm doing and you're panicking as I'm trying to explain this, thinking that you're having to go into the lab and do it. Both extremes, we lose the students. And when they get into the lab, they either have missed the little piece of important information they needed, or they don't know how to function. And so when we provide these podcasts, it's like having a personal TA in the pocket. The student can pull out that resource and use it when they are about to approach that piece of machinery, that piece of glassware, and it will take them through step by step how to use that particular technique. This is especially essential, again, when you have one instructor to 25 or 30 students. We like to think of teaching in a laboratory as an apprenticeship model, but you know in an apprenticeship there's usually one expert and maybe 2 to 3 novices, and in a laboratory setting it's more like 1 to 25. And so the other thing that we feel like is really important is that these podcasts can be targeted to our students using exactly the equipment that they're going to use. So it's not some resource that I've pulled offline that explains how to use a particular pipette that we don't have and I have to go back and remediate and explain again. Well, that's not really how yours looks. Yours has a blue stripe on it instead of a, you get the idea. And so we can target it exactly what they need. Of course, there are additional uses for these mobile devices. Our students have used them to capture photos and video that they've embedded in their electronically submitted lab report. This is actually a page from one of my freshman student lab reports. They use them as timers, calculators, flashlights, their apps that they can use on them. And of course, we use them frequently for their search engines, which are very useful when we're doing lab stuff. I want to show you just a little bit of data that's been presented at EDUCAUSE conferences before, just to give you a little bit of background, and if you'd like to talk about this more afterwards, I'd be glad to talk to you about it. I did a quasi-experimental design where I had some students who had podcast access and some students who received the same information in lecture format. And one of the first questions we wanted to ask is, would the students use the podcast? Because they weren't required to. And so we actually tracked student usage in the lab, and you can see here are the titles of the different podcasts, total access events per laboratory team, not per individual student, and then mean access events per team over the semester. And if we look at this, students are accessing a podcast at least 3 times during a single laboratory session that lasts about 4 hours. So we know that they were using them. We next looked at, using a carefully devised tool, we looked at interactions between teaching assistants and students because we wanted to know how this was affecting the teaching assistants' interactions with the students. And we found that whenever the podcast treatment group had access to these podcasts, there was a statistically significant reduction in the number of times that those TAs had to intervene to correct something that was going on. Now that's a very brief explanation. I can give you a fuller explanation if you'd like one. But basically, these students were able to perform the techniques and the basic lab skills more independently, which allows the TAs more time to talk about the more important things that we'd like to be, our students to be learning, rather than just basic skill things. And that was, you can see the Cohen's D effect size at the bottom is a 2.18, which is a very large effect size. Of course, we're also interested in how our students perform. So on mean outcome measures, we see in the podcast treatment group and the lecture treatment group, there were no statistically significant differences, and that's actually good news because that means that the students are getting from the electronic resources at least the same level of support that I'm able to give them in person, and you better believe that I work really hard in my labs to make sure that they're getting the support they need. So it was quite a relief to me to know that they could use these electronic resources in an effective way. And then finally, when we broke out and looked for interaction effects, one of the things we found was that if we looked at students who we rated to have a high participation level, so these were students in the lecture course that's associated with this lab, who were attended regularly, who turned in all of their homework, who attended tutoring sessions, these students actually showed a statistically significantly higher average in the lab if they had podcast availability. Which actually makes sense, because if they're a student who is proactively going after what they can get from a course, they're more likely to take advantage of a resource that's available on a voluntary basis. And so we felt like this was a pretty good indication that this was being these resources were being used well. All right, so to the NGLC grant. We were fortunate enough to receive an NGLC grant with 2 partner institutions. And they are California University of Pennsylvania and Del Mar College in Corpus Christi. And we have Rob and Daisy here this afternoon from Del Mar who are going to tell you about implementation of Meeble on their campuses. But the reason these partners were important to us is because we're trying to scale it to different settings, places that have a different student population than we do. We're a small private university. We were giving iPhones to all of our students, so there was device saturation. Louise lives in a rural setting, teaches in a much larger school. It's a public four-year university. Rob and Daisy are at Del Mar, which is a public two-year community college, which is even larger. And so we felt like this was a good test to see whether or not it would translate to a new place. In order to jumpstart this project, we had a week-long workshop in Abilene last summer where we brought together faculty from the three universities and we talked about best practices in deploying mobile devices and mobile technology in laboratory settings, shared a lot of ideas, talked about nuts and bolts of preparing podcasts and preparing electronic resources, and actually did some of that preparation during that week. You'll notice that there are a lot more than three people at this workshop. Each of these universities brought a team of people from various STEM disciplines and tech support personnel because we can support each other better when we know what each other are doing and are working together and growing together. And so out of that project, I just wanted to show you some pictures. We don't have anybody here from CalU to tell their story, but on the right here, we have people from Louise Nicholson's genetics class. With some of her money from the grant, she chose to buy some iPads for in-lab use and also purchase some iPods so that students could take those home and have them with them at all times. And then at Del Mar, Rob and Daisy will tell you about their iPad use in lab, and I think they've done some really creative and exciting things. And then in chemistry, of course, at ACU, that's where I'm working, and we have student-owned devices. And now, at this level, it's been 5 years since we started that deployment program. We have a combination of iPads, iPods, and iPhones, and so they can use any one of those devices. And by the way, I don't think saturation is important. As long as you have one of these devices per lab team, you've got what you need. So really, a 50% saturation rate is good enough. So I think now I'm going to hand this off to Rob and let him talk about his adventures in Meeble deployment.
Hi, folks. How's everyone? So how many professors do we have here, or educators? Okay, and then how many IT folks? IT, okay, and then how many instructional design folks? Okay, so did I miss anyone? Okay, so I'm going to try to give you the ground up how we started. Has anyone in here ever done a video? Everyone? A few? About half of you? Okay. Have you done a podcast with the critical lab technique? Okay. So you know some of the mechanics of how to do this already, correct? No? Yes? Okay. Was it like a short one, 6 to 8 minutes? Or no? Long one? Short and long?
Okay. Here you go.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Okay, well, we didn't know what the audience would be, if you'd be, naive to podcasts, so I want to make sure. So just to give you, we started from the ground zero generating these podcasts, and they're basically critical lab techniques that we needed to do in majors biology and intro to biotechnology. And so the critical lab techniques, like pipetting, okay, you've probably heard about that if you're a scientist. And these are laser targeted to, for example, technical schools have state skills standards that they have to follow. So the beauty of this is we can laser target these skills to those state standards that we have to give our students, and they're actually tested on in the class before they graduate. Also, they're using exactly the technology that we have in the lab. Okay, there's a lot of podcasts that are on YouTube and other sources, but there's different equipment or a little different skill set that you might need to do. And I know that generating a podcast can be labor intensive. You agree? You have to write a script, and you have to, you could put together a storyboard, where you're going to decide what graphics or images you're going to show. But again, the script is what drives the whole thing, right? Not the storyboard. So you're using the visuals to enhance what you're saying on the screen. And I think if you can take it's rare that you can get one take, right? If you've done a podcast, it's rare you can get one take. But if you can get a good audio and video signal together, it can really increase your workflow. And that's what I tried to do when I was generating these podcasts with Daisy. And so we used the camera, this camera here. It's a Canon HV20. And I don't think they make it anymore. But the important thing here is it has a FireWire output jack and an external microphone. Because if you don't have a good soundtrack, I think the podcast is not useful as an instructional tool. You can have a little snowy video, but if your podcast has terrible audio, it's not going to be instructional. So a lot of the consumer-type cameras don't have an external mic jack. You probably know that. And you have to almost get in the prosumer or professional level to get an external mic jack. Now, this jack that's on my camera is not powered, so I have to have this little battery powered system that I put in line with the microphone to make it work. And also, there's many microphones you're aware of, a shotgun mic, we have those as well. These are some of the equipment that we have that's kind of basic. The shotgun mic, of course, will you can set it on a tripod, you can have a lavalier mic. We also then used video capture software, Camtasia and ScreenFlow. And this semester I'm having a real challenge because I'm going through three platforms. I'm on the Unix platform, I'm on the Windows, and I'm on Mac. And so basically I almost have to have screen capture for all those platforms. So I didn't anticipate that challenge, but there's many challenges. Then of course, you can use a number of video editing tools. I use iMovie, and I found that that's pretty effective, and it does enough. There's enough editing tools in there where I can get a reasonable podcast out of it. We've been able to decrease our workflow from like a whole weekend of filming and editing and trying to export the product to where we can get done in one afternoon now. What we did, it took us a weekend now. And so we've disseminated it largely on Dropbox. We're finding technical challenges with course website didn't have enough storage space for some of the, even a mobile version of podcast is about 50 megabytes, and we couldn't load that up. So we started having a public site or address to Dropbox, and then the students can access that 24/7, basically. And that's something we find is, you know, when they can look at this critical skill or lab technique on a recursive basis, 24/7, we think that that's going to have a much better effect, at least on our cohort. I know that Cynthia has done that already, but we're just starting to get to that where they can have access to it on a 24/7 basis. Here's a setup that we have, and there's Daisy with a biotech student. She's standing in front of a DNA sequencer, and she's actually, we put our iPods on a tripod. We found that that was a good way to deploy them in the lab so that they wouldn't fall down, basically, and students with gloves could handle them without worrying about dropping them. And she's actually showing how to sequence DNA on this DNA sequencer and recording it on the iPad so the students can refer to that at a later date. So there's a real-time kind of podcast that she's been doing. And then here you can see a closer kind of setup for the podcast. It's also on a tripod, so it's secure. And that's one of the podcasts loaded. And like Cynthia already mentioned, you can leverage the students that already have these mobile devices and cluster them around. So we have like four students around, and they're looking at a podcast together, and we do that before the lab really starts, and then when the lab is going, we'll have headsets around so they can go back and look at it if they want to, and they do often do that. And then we're going to have them so they can look to their own mobile device as well. Here you can just see the students discussing different things in the podcast. Okay, and I have I'll show you a bit of one. We've done at least 12 or 14 of these, and they're usually 6 or 8 minutes.
In this video, I'm going to demonstrate aseptic technique and the major steps setting up bacteriophage plates. First, you want to spray 70% of alcohol. Clean your bench area thoroughly. Next, grab a Bunsen burner. Light up the flame. You want to adjust the flame a little bit so you won't burn yourself, at the same time create a very sterilized environment around your operation. Okay. So first, you're going to mix 50 microliter of...
Okay, so this is... I think what we like about this is exact equipment the student has to use in the lab, and there's no podcast that I could find on the web that exactly like that, using the same brand of pipettes, the same Bunsen burner, which is a remote one. A lot of labs have the... We also have gas piped into this lab, but we don't have enough spots for all the students, so we have to get these butane containers that they have at their bench. So they're going to do this exact technique. Now, we're finding... we have kind of an informal survey we give every week in lab, and we tabulated it up, and about 95% of the students are saying that this is a very useful technique, that they find it very useful. And we're finding, well, actually studies are coming out, maybe you know about them, that students that use podcasts that have learning disorders, they get this. I mean, a lot of students live in the YouTube world, and they want to see a video. When they see a block of text, even if it's animated or has well laid out diagrams, the podcast is indispensable to those students. They get it. They see that. You know, you'll have a good student that doesn't have any learning disorders look at the text and they go, I don't really get how you do this pipetting. We show it on this podcast. Oh, I get it. And it kind of just crystallizes in their mind. And so we think that from a grassroots standpoint, this is a great technique. Now, it does take a little more time, but once you get the database of podcasts, we found, and Cynthia also found, that she was not hoarded by the students in lab. I mean, has anyone taught a lab class in here before? At the end of it, are you like ready to have a couple of martinis? Well, okay. The idea is that the students, we don't let them, you know, if it's on the podcast, we make them go see the podcast again. And we find that it's a lot easier on the instructor. Then we can go around and really help students that need something. This can be platform agnostic, so it doesn't have to be on one platform or another. And I think there's other benefits that we're finding from this that I really believe that we've been throwing technology at students for decades. And oftentimes, I don't think it's really worked. I think this is the first time we're going to see it to work. And the other thing that we're hoping, with a 24/7 deployment of iPads with every student in one class, and they'll even have electronic books, we're going to see students using FaceTime. Okay, if you don't know what FaceTime is, it's a video conferencing tool that's on the Apple platform, and if you're in a Wi-Fi zone, you can FaceTime, and you don't have to have any configuration. You just sit there and acknowledge the person that you want to FaceTime with them, and boom, you're connected. Now think about that, especially for a 2-year school. Where we're located, we're not a residential college. So students don't have the dormitory or the cafeteria to meet up and study. So they're, you know, working jobs, many of them. They could go on their break, hop on their mobile device, video conference into another student, and ask them how to do this calculus question, or how do we do this question in biotechnology? So you can have an impromptu study session. Well, why is that important? Well, we know from social theory that when you build community, that nurtures learning. So that is building community through mobile devices. The other thing is, studies done at ACU have shown that iPads are used more than a laptop. And that's kind of intuitive because they're so convenient, right? They're easy to travel with. They have flash memory. They're instant on. So there's a detailed study done by colleagues at ACU that showed that iPads were being, you know, more utilized than a laptop. Well, with a laptop, you have to open it up. You have to wait till it boots up. And so it makes sense, I think, from that standpoint that these mobile devices, you know, iPhone is a hyper mobile device. I know people that have reported that they take it to bed with them. I mean, they can't divorce themselves from the device. They're so attached to it. So that's kind of all I had to say. Daisy's going to talk about some more different areas we've gone with the iPad from this basic initial starting with the Meeble.
I'm Daisy Zhang, and I'm the leading lady in that podcast. I'm assistant professor of biotechnology from Dartmouth College. I was recruited by Rob to get involved in this grant. Was a little bit skeptical in the beginning, but right now I'm 100% convinced. I'm going to talk a little bit about assessment of this grant a little bit, and then I have extended iPad a little bit other than podcast in my program, which is biotechnology, so I will talk a little bit about that. So what we did on the assessment is at the end of each lab, after they have finished watching the podcast and did their experiment, we give them one-page survey, and then we look at their feedback. To summarize it, most students feel more confident planning the experiment and, you know, use the equipment, calculating and analyze result. And I have to talk about the calculation a little bit. Came from China, I was a little bit surprised how difficult math is to the first year students in a community college. And what I have found out is in biotechnology class, they don't have to know that much overall about math, but they need to know the math that exactly what they need to know in that class. So if we make short podcast to explain just one equation, let them just review it over and over again, they can get it, that's great. And the student like that part the best. And then surprise, they want more detail, they want more podcast, you know, in their feedback. And they also like the podcast with some humorous element in there. I thought it would be distracting, but they don't get distracted. They actually got more focused, to my surprise. And other than, you know, watching the podcast, my biotechnology, other classes, the students from those classes found the visual apps very helpful, and I will talk about those later. So basically, I'm very convinced that students like to see more than read. That's for sure, you know, after using the iPad in my classes. Okay, so the difficulties we encountered, we just started to do that last semester, fall 2011, so that's just like 3-4 months. Of course, Rob mentioned the accessibility of the podcast. Those files are huge, and I'm not IT specialist, and we have trouble. So what we have found out, there is a link on Dropbox he has mentioned. It's called the copy public link. Anybody in the audience know about Dropbox can find that. It's very useful. You can, my students, they don't even have to have an account in Dropbox. You can copy that link and then send it by email or post in your Blackboard and they can get it. That's very useful. Also, we have trouble to give them enough time to review in the first semester before the lab. You know, we also involve in other two grants. So the time and manpower is a problem. And then for at the beginning of the fall semester, what we have been doing is we sync all the podcasts in those apps and give it to students to view during the lab. And when they played it all together, it's pretty distracting sometimes. It was a little bit chaotic. So here are the things we're trying to improve this semester. Like I was saying, we're trying to get a bigger space online for the students to look at them. And also, I have found out students likes to make videos themselves. And actually, way before I know the term podcast, I saw the Apple lady nodding. I think the podcast was invented by students. I really think I have one or two students have problem, learning disability, and they will have tape recorder, they will have even a camera that can make video way back, one or two years ago, just that, recently. They will make video of the technique I try to explain during my biotechnology class, and they went home and look at those videos over and over again. They had done this before we tried to scale it up. So we're trying to encourage experienced students and the TA, our teaching assistant, to make podcasts themselves. So that would just, they don't get paid to do that, but they will give us, they like to do that. They will give us a lot of resources we can choose from. And then we have purchased headsets for each of the iPads so they can actually view those podcasts quietly in the middle of the experiment. So we're improving this semester. Okay, so this is, now I'm going to have to talk a little bit about my program, the biotechnology program. This is a program, it's a working-based training program. We're trying to make a lot of, skilled technicians for biotechnology field. So it's very hands-on classes, and I'm pretty much teaching all the classes, a young program. And what I found out is iPads, it's a perfect fit for this program. I totally believe what everybody has been talking about, to using mobile device, you need to be specific. You need to find what's fit your program the best and try this for 4 months. This is totally what I believe. So after the Mabel and after I extend a little bit, this is what I think how iPads has changed the way we teach and interact with students. Students get more involved with your project, so instead of being told, they take in charge, even starting from designing the experiment. I'm using this particular app as example. It's the qPCR MIQE app from BioRad. qPCR stands for quantitative PCR. Basically, it's a very sophisticated experiment to look at the gene expression on the level of checking the mRNA. So it's really hard to set it up. A year before when I teach this class, I have to give them a stack of handout, last 2 weeks to just to get to the point they can run an experiment. This app basically provide a tutoring as individual TA for them. They can look at every single component of this sophisticated technique, and they can do checklist, they can discuss result, and they can communicate with their team member. Okay. So on that note, they have a better communication with each other and with me as well, because we can all set up in one team, and then we can look at each other's, the troubleshooting. So I guess I know there's not all of you major in science, but in a nutshell, it's such a treat for me. I found out this app in my bioinstrumentation class. It's really, really helpful. Try to wrap this up a little bit quicker. And another thing is I found out after one semester, I have small group. I have 12 to 15 students in each of my class. But even in that small group, my students shows a sense of community in the classroom through iPads. We have set up this Wi-Fi signal separate from our on-campus overall Wi-Fi. So the Wi-Fi is really strong. We use the same username and password. In the classroom, not for the paid app, just for the free app. So all my students, they can actually purchase those apps they find is very useful. And one person gathers apps on the iPad, and the other student automatically pick it up on their iPad and immediately try it. I found that's really, really helpful. And then I have to mention Dropbox again. So the sense of community can be extended to other school. We were doing this HHM collaboration to study bacteriophage. It's a virus from soil, basically. And Delmar, we don't have electron microscope to look at the images. So when we send the slides, our students put their samples on the slides, send it to UNT, which is our brother school, support us technically. They actually, on their side, they can photograph the electron microscope image. And then immediately each image they can put in the Dropbox, and our student can go to that Dropbox on their iPad to look at their data hundreds of miles away. You know, that kind of communication, I think it's really amazing. So I guess to summarize this, I only tried it for 4 months so far, but in biotechnology program, this is just starting. And my student helping me with app, looking for apps and helping me with ideas, and they totally got involved. So I think I'm going to head back to Cynthia again. She's going to summarize our talk. Thanks.
Okay. So I'm going to wrap up a little bit and tell you how we've been trying to assess this project. When we started the Meeble project, we looked at how students were using the podcast, how much they were using them, how it affected the interactions with their teaching assistants, and outcome measures. And now we're trying to look at that deeper learning piece. And any of you who have tried to measure deeper learning know that that's a real challenge. So the way we're trying to do this is three-pronged. First of all, we're looking at faculty-student surveys, and Rob and Daisy have both mentioned some of the outcome of some of those surveys. By and large, the reaction we get from students and faculty is very, very positive. We've also collected mid and end of semester writing assessments. Now, these are assessments where we've asked students to tell us what they've learned in lab, what they understood, what they didn't understand, what connections they're making with what they're learning perhaps in their lecture class, and what connections they're making with things around them in the real world. And these are being assessed by independent readers using a solo taxonomy rubric that will allow us to look at the level of thought that these students are expressing in their personal writing. And we're going to make some adjustments this semester. Not all of those assessments were done in class, and we would prefer not to assess how well Wikipedia understands this stuff, and so we're going to be doing all of those assessments in class this time. But the data I want to show you that's preliminary is from something called the ASSIST, which is a tool that comes out of the Enhancing Teaching and Learning Project in the UK. It's the Approaches and Study Skills Inventory for Students, and it's a self-report measure that allows students to respond to questions that should give us a read on how deeply they are approaching their studying. And so I want to show you the three primary subscales that are a part of that measure. And these first three slides are from our entire cohort. So these are all of the students who have been in our inquiry-based labs this semester. And we see no significant differences in their deep approach from beginning of semester to end. You can see that there were some small differences in means. And that difference in mean total was a little bit higher. We would like to see that to be significant in the Meeble group, but this is, again, our overall group. Then there's a subcategory, subscale called strategic approach, and we do have three significant differences from time one and time two. And time one is at the beginning of the semester, and time two is at the end of the semester, and 3 months isn't very long to shift a person's approach to studying, okay? So, the three differences that we saw, though, is that they apparently, and remember this is a freshman-heavy group, were much more optimistic about their time management skills at the beginning of the semester than they were at the end. Not surprising, right before final exam weeks, they're not thinking they're quite as good time managers. They also rate themselves to be a lot more alert to assessment demands, and that's probably a good thing. I don't know if any of you have taught first semester freshmen, but the average of my first test in general chemistry is not good. And it's usually because they just don't realize what it's going to be like to be at the university level taking a chemistry class. And so now they're a lot more alert to what they are going to need to be doing in order to be successful. And they are perhaps a little less optimistic about their ability to achieve. And so we see some significant differences in that scale. And this is one that makes us say, ouch. But again, remember that these are freshman students, again, heavy on the freshman chemistry, which is my fault. I have about 150 students who come in pre-med, and by Christmas time, I have about 70 who are now pre-med. And it's not all because of chemistry. Some of it's because of biology and, you know, other things. But those students who know that they will not be continuing in chemistry the next semester are shouting loudly that they now have a lack of purpose in being in chemistry class. So you see a very spike in that. And whenever you feel lack of purpose, you tend to do more unrelated memorizing and tend to be a little bit more bound to your syllabus. And so we do see this surface apathetic approach increase in the entire cohort. But here's what we'd like to see, and we are seeing in our upper division class at CalU. And because the sample size is so low, we don't have enough power to see statistical significance. But if you just eyeball these, notice that in the Meeble group on the left and the non-Meeble group on the right, both are being taught with inquiry-based approaches. The mean value for deep approach goes up in each case, but it goes up a lot more for the Meeble group. Strategic approach, we don't see just a huge change. The biggest change we see in the Meeble group is in surface apathetic group, and that goes down, which is a good thing. And again, power is low, a sample size is low. We hope as we continue to collect data that this will hold up and we will see statistical significance. And these are upper division genetic students. So we have already, I'm sorry, kind of weeded out the students who aren't going to go on in this field. And so these are students who are a little bit more motivated and are taking it seriously. And the fact that we can make a difference, perhaps, in their approaches to studying, even at this level, is a really exciting thing, I think. Okay. So just a few more observations, and then we really would like to hear from you if you have questions. This is a picture that I took 4 years ago when I was first beginning to deploy iPhones. And I took it, I don't know if you can tell from back there, you probably can't because of light, because I thought it was really funny. These two students were watching a podcast on an iPhone, and they were sharing a headset, and so one had one earpiece in one ear, and the other had an earpiece in the other ear. And but the reason I put it in this presentation is because the young lady on the left is a young lady named Emily Sumner. She is a music major who also happens to be pre-med, and I'm the pre-med advisor at ACU, and so I advise her. And she was in that first class where we used iPhones and started doing that. And this semester, she will be graduating. She's graduating in the honors program and is doing a senior honors project where she's using an app on her iPhone to measure pulse rates of people as they listen to different types of music. And so I'm taking her through the process of learning how to do number crunch and do those statistics and collect that data and how you set up a study. And, you know, that began when she was doing inquiry-based science in her general chemistry lab and had to learn how to set up an experiment and was using that device. And so I think, you know, we're spurning students, we're spawning students who are seeing that these can be used for research and are excited about doing that. Now, this is a totally random picture, but it's not as random as it may seem. This is an amazing sculpture that's in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and that's my husband and myself and a colleague. And this sculpture is called Floralis Generica, and it is an 18-ton metal flower. And it is an interesting combination of technology and art. And this flower, which, mind you, is 18 tons, every morning opens to the sun and points toward the sun, and every night closes. And I think it's a good word picture, maybe, of what we're trying to do in education. If you think of education as that 18-ton flower, we are trying to move an 18-ton flower. You know, we have been educating students for centuries, and we are trying to wed technology to education and make it do something wonderful. And it's going to take time, and what we're doing here is just a drop in the bucket. But I hope eventually we'll have something really fantastic. When they saw this in 2002, all ready to go, had been working on it for years, it wouldn't open for the first 2 months. Well, you know, sometimes things we try don't open. So wanted to share the picture and just tell you that we have no illusions that we've already opened the flower, but we're working on it. Those of us the Meeble Project have a blog/website that has a whole bunch of information on it. We think that this is a really good approach for those of you that might be at a small community college and have perhaps a lot of adjunct faculty members. If you have some full-time faculty members who can prepare some resources and share them with some of your adjuncts, this might be a way to sort of standardize some of your instruction. If you teach at a very large university and you have multiple TAs, this might be a way that you can standardize some of your instruction. Very shortly, under the workshop link, there will be an online course workshop that will detail all of the stuff that we did this summer. We'll give you some information on our ongoing assessment and some information on best practices that we've gleaned through our experiences. And all of our contact information is there, and we would invite you to contact us. We'd love to talk to you. And we'd also love to answer questions if you have any. We've got time, I think. So does anybody have any questions? I know it's after lunch. You guys all look so excited. This is what I tell my students. You look so excited. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
We hear a lot from faculty who say, I don't have time to do that podcast.
Right.
And I think that we need to turn that around. So we don't have to do that very busy. Because the students do love to generate time.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you like to do that for me? Right, right. There you go.
Right.
Yeah, well, you know, we actually think reading is a pretty important thing, so we would like them to do both. And I think one of the things that we all would say is these don't have to be professional quality in order to be useful. You know, I am a chemist, and I can't go over to our really fancy studio and film these things because they don't have a lab over there, and I can't explode things over there. You know, so it really has to happen with me, with my little green sheet of paper sitting behind my thing and my little video camera, and sometimes a colleague will come in. It doesn't have to be that fancy in order to be really useful.
Well, I just want to mention that before this grant, I actually had students doing podcasts. I've been doing that for about 6 years. I have them on various techniques. And the reason I went to that is I started, you know, if you do the traditional paper, you'll find that 52% of the students will go online and just cut and paste from Wikipedia, and they think it's okay. They think that's okay. So I thought, well, actually, I had received a Department of Ed grant, and I got these laptops for the lab, these computer carts, and they had a package where they gave us these video cameras with it. And I thought, well, how am I going to use this in the classroom? And I started thinking and brainstorming. I thought, well, I'll have them do a scientific paper, but it's going to be visual, where they have to use peer-reviewed journal articles, and they have to defend their standpoint and present data. At the end, in the rolling credits, that's where the peer-reviewed journal citations go. And, you know, they're 5 to 8 minutes. And it's amazing some of the quality that came out of that. And I even let students, well, you can interview people, too, as, you know, experts. And one day I set up a two-camera system, you know, like they have, and mic'd the student. And he went crazy. And he was using green screen and all kinds of advanced techniques. And then we were playing this in a faculty's office. And other faculty walking by and go, well, what TV station was that on? And they're going, that's a student-produced video. And I think that they can get really engaged with the videos if you let them do it yourself. Now, for this project, we wanted to standardize the techniques so that they were correct, and so we didn't have the students do the videos in this particular project because that was kind of the letter of the grant. But
yes. Yes and no, not. When I had a hearing impaired student last year, and so I used Camtasia to screen capture and put pertinent information at the bottom, so it wasn't verbatim what was on there, but it was enough so that she could catch the gist of the importance. And then seeing the technique, I mean, she could see the technique. I have been asked before about visually impaired students, and I have to answer honestly, I haven't had visually impaired students in a chemistry lab, and I really think there would be some bigger challenges than just the podcasting for a visually impaired student. So,
there is a rudimentary closed captioning on YouTube. It's you'd have to, I guess it's not real accurate, the translation, but if you had a student, you could put it through YouTube, and at least from a starting point, you'd have to probably edit it, the final, but good question. Okay.
It's good to know.
Yeah, good to know.
That's how medicine happens these days, too. Yeah. Well, we don't want to hold you captive if you have other things to do. Thank you very much for being here. We'd all love to talk to you.
Thanks.